Good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about how system calls work in XV6. We also talked about how other kinds of exceptions were handled in XV6. We mentioned we had this single trap routine that did everything, so timer interrupts, input and output, all went through this one place where we just had a bunch of if statements and switch statements to figure out what to do. We started talking about context switches. We talked about the general idea that we want to switch to other programs. Maybe the program's been running for too long. Maybe it's done waiting for input. And we talked about how XV6's context switch implementation works a bit. And I ended up hastily on this question. Just as a test of understanding, we'll take this variant question, which is very slightly different, and see what you think about that. And you can check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what should happen there. Who would like some more time? Okay, a couple people. Give another 30 seconds or so. Okay, who thinks A, B, C, D, E, F, G? Okay, so we're, any other thing? So we have consensus for B. And one way of remembering this, so we have this picture where we had like these two phases for our process-to-process context switch. First, we go from user to kernel mode, and when we do that, we save all the user regs, which includes the program counter, and the stack pointer and EAX to the kernel stack. So when we're saving the registers here, we haven't decided whether or not we're context switching yet. So that's one way you can exclude the possibility of the other process being involved in where we're saving things, because we haven't even decided we're context switching to it by the time we need to save all the user registers in order to run other stuff in kernel mode. And well, it would be like sensible to save the registers to the user stack, but XV6 has made this choice to use this kernel stack to avoid disrupting the user stack. This way we don't have to worry about things like, are we going to run out of stack space sometimes, you know, when we have a timer interrupt? We just say, we don't care what the user is doing with their stack. We don't even care if their stack pointer is valid. We're just going to save everything for them. In a safe place that we know is safe because the kernel is the only one using it. Okay, so questions about the idea? Okay, so there's one few more details about the context switch like we go over. So we mentioned that we had, once we're in, saved all the user registers, we're in kernel mode, we call this special switch function, which we call from one thread and return to another. We call with one stack and one set of registers and return from an older call to switch, you know, as if we had just switched away during that call and switched back. And this was where we were saving the second set of, you know, the kernel registers, the registers from that trap function, which was figuring out what I want to do to run another program. We're saving those registers for that final piece. So that's the steady state. And in this picture, like, if we're switching to B, we have to have a call to switch that already happened to return from. And that certainly is going to happen most of the time while B is running, because, you know, after we're running B for a while, it's just going to keep calling switch when we're done running it and want to wait for something to happen. And return from that when we're done waiting. But the question is, like, what about the first call to switch? When we start a new program, you know, we have to have a new thread, so a new program, new thread, new stack. How do we actually make switching to that new program work? Because the way I did for a context switch assumes we're switching to something which already called switch in the past. And XV6 and many operating systems use this nice trick to avoid modifying their switch routine. They just have one version of switch. There's no special cases in it for is this a new thing or not a new thing. Instead, they carefully set up the stack of the new thread to look like the stack of a function that just finished calling switch. So we know that when we call switch, there will be some register saved and a stack pointer and a return address. We just set those things up in our new stack the same way they would be set up if we had actually called switch from that thread. And this means that our switch function is our only code to switch to the thread, and we just use that normally after we do this special setup. So questions about this idea? Okay, so we can see XV6's version of this code is in a function called alloc_proc, which returns a struct proc, which represents a process. We'll talk more about what's in there later. One of the things in there is a kernel stack pointer. And what this does is it sets up the kernel stack pointer. So first it figures out the top of the stack, and then it just pushes things onto the stack manually by just using this pointer to the stack, dereferencing it to add something to the stack, and then decrementing it. So first we put a trap frame on there. You might say, why do we put a trap frame? And the reason is because this is how the trap function is called, with a trap frame stored on the stack. Then we put the return address for the trap function, where the trap function returns to on the stack. So we're setting up the stack so far as if we're in the middle of trap about to return. And we're about to return with a certain set of registers ready to be restored when we're done with this exception. And on top of that, we put a return from a function related to a system call, and then to switch. So the idea is that when we switch to this thread, what's going to happen is we're going to first look at our saved kernel registers from switch. Switch is going to pop those from the stack, and it's going to return to a function called forkret. Forkret is a little bit of a fake of a system call we'll talk about later. And that's going to return as if it's returning from a trap. So it's going to return to the same code that trap returns to. And that code's going to look and assume that it's stored on its stack the saved user registers. And it's going to restore those saved user registers and then return from the current exception into user mode. So this is how we start a new program. So we switch to this kernel thread and we restore the registers, and then we go to returning from trap, and we start the program just as if we were returning from a system call. We run, in fact, the exact same code. We reuse the return from system call code for starting a program fresh. So questions about this basic idea? This is a stack where if you like read the stack in a debugger, it says, we're in the middle of a call to switch in the middle of a system call, basically. Yeah.
It might be kind of irrelevant, but like, what's the difference between a thread and process?
So the question is, what's the difference between a thread and a process? A thread refers to the part of a process that basically represents a virtual CPU. So a program counter and some registers. And there's other things a process has, like open files, which aren't part of the thread.
So what's the difference like in, say, in creating a new thread and creating a new process?
The question is, what's the difference between creating a new thread and creating a new process? So this function I'm showing you here creates a new process. I'm only showing the part of it which creates the thread part of the process. There's other parts of this function which like set up the address space, set up all the memory, which set up the open files, and other things we'll talk about in a bit. Yeah?
When you start a new process, does it always immediately run?
The question is, when you start a new process, does it always immediately run? The way XV6 works, it is always immediately runnable. So note that something I'm not doing in this code is actually switching to the new thread. But in XV6, it happens to always be immediately runnable. That's not a choice every operating system needs to make. Okay, other questions? Yeah. Question is, can I give a scenario when I start a process without running it? This is a valid thing to do in most cases. Like, we create a process and wait for an opportunity to run it. Let's say it's lower priority than what's running now, would be the logic behind that. Okay. Yeah. I'll take back first. Yeah. So the process starts at this function called forkret, and all forkret does is return again into trapret, basically. It turns out that forkret is the base, is the code for returning from a system call. We'll talk about why it's called forkret later today. And trapret is just the where trap returns to. Is that? So the question is, why do we put trapret and forkret on the stack? The idea is that we're reusing more code this way. Because there's some setup we have to do before we return from trap for the new process. And that's done in forkret. But we still want to reuse the return from system call code as is. Yeah?
Since this is a new thread, what gets put onto the user space registers, or like placeholders?
The question is, what gets put in the user space registers? So that's a good question. And we allocate space for them. And there might be other code in this function or in forkret that actually uses this pointer tf to set them before we actually return from the trap. Because we can modify these saved registers here anytime up until we actually return from the trap and have that take effect when we actually run the thread. Because that's what's going to be copied into the registers later. So other questions? Okay. So one thing this brings up is the notion of we have information that represents a process, and you know, we need to know what that is. And we saw that there was this struct proc. And this is what's generically called a process control block. It's all the information we need to know to control this process. So an XV6 is a struct proc. Other operating systems are going to have other names for it. So here's the entire definition of struct proc from XV6. And let's go through some interesting things in here. We have pointers to the current state of the registers and the program counter. And these are usually pointers to the kernel stack, assuming the process is not running right now. If it's running right now, you shouldn't use these pointers because it's on the CPU, and you know, we can't change things indirectly while it's on the CPU. We need to be running as it. So this is what we call our thread state. You know, this is the thread, basically. We have a pointer to the kernel stack, which we saw earlier, so we can find that. because we're going to need to deallocate it when the process finishes at least. We have some information about, is the process running? Is it waiting? Is it finished? Is it killed? Is it waiting? And the biggest way this is stored in XP6 is this state variable, which is either unused for a process which isn't doing anything right now, embryo for a process which is just about to start but isn't ready to run yet. That would be while we're in the middle of alloc proc and still setting up the stack and so on. Sleeping for a process which is waiting for something to happen, like waiting for a key press. Runnable for a process which I could switch to right now, but no one is actually running yet. Running for a process that's on some core, that's running on some core right now, so I can't switch to it because it's already running. And zombie for a process which is finished, but hasn't been cleaned up yet. And we'll talk more about that in a bit. We also have a process ID. So this is to identify the process and system calls. So for example, there's a system call to kill or stop a process, and it takes a process ID so we can figure out what process are we referring to. Since in user space we don't have pointers to the struct proc, we have to use something else to identify which process do I want. We have information about the memory of the process. So in XP6, there's two variables in the process control block related to this. There's SC, used by the OS, which is how much memory is allocated for it. And there's the actual page table. We'll talk about that much more later in the semester. And we also have information about open files. So there's an array of open files, and also information about what directory the process is CD'd to, which we need because we're going to handle all those system calls that deal with files. And I think the only thing I left off is we have a name here, which is just for debugging. So when we print out an error message, we can print out what process caused the error. So any question about anything you saw in the process control block? Yeah. Yeah. The question is, what's the 16 in the char name 16? We have 16 characters to store the process name. If it's bigger than that, we truncate it. Yeah.
What did you say Chan was?
Question, what did it say Chan? So Chan is related to processes which are sleeping. So we need to know what are they waiting for, and Chan is how we store that information. So it's going to have a different value if I'm waiting for a key press versus if I'm waiting for a certain amount of time to pass. Yeah?
What's the difference between the trap frame and the context?
So the question is, what's the difference between the trap frame and the context? So the context is the information used by switch to start running the program in the kernel. The trap frame is what's going to be used when we return from the trap function. So the trap frame contains the user registers that are going to be restored the next time we run this program. Versus the context contains the kernel registers that would be used next time we run this program. So most notably, when we're accessing the trap frame, the most common place we're accessing is like from a system call. We want to change like the return value. That's in the trap frame because that's one of the user registers. Whereas the context we're mostly going to use to switch to this process. Yeah?
What sets the process name?
What? Question is, what sets the process name? It's the thing you use to spawn a new process, to spawn a different program in your process, sets the process name. Okay. Other questions? So we have all this information in our process control blocks. So in XP6, in the kernel code, you may have seen myproc. So this is a function to retrieve the currently active, currently running process control block. So it retrieves a pointer to the currently running struct proc. And this is a subset of the code for it. So there's a global variable called CPUs, which is equal to the number of cores we're running. When we're developing XV6, I always set it to 1 to keep things simple, but XV6 supports multiple cores. So we have an entry in this array for every core. And inside this struct CPU is a pointer to the currently running process on the CPU. So when we switch to a process, another thing we do is we set that pointer so we can call myproc and always look it up. And we have this myCPU function, which just looks up the entry in this array corresponding to whatever core we're on. So to do that, we have some code which reads a special register saying, what's the ID of this this core to figure out which entry of the array to use. So questions about this? Okay, so that's about sort of our process control block. So for most of the rest of, or a lot of the rest of today, I'll be talking at a higher level. So like we've looked at like what happens internally in XV6 and how processes are made. I'm going to look at, well, what's the user interface for that? I'm not going to talk about XV6 in particular. I'm going to talk about Unix. So XV6 is Unix-like. And this is an arbitrary choice. Like, I could do Windows. I could do VMS. We're using Unix-like OSs, partly because we have source code for them, so I can easily like tell you what they actually do, and partly because you've used them before, like in 2150. It's like our primary environment. And they've been around for a while, so they're pretty popular. And because our XV6 is imitating Unix, but it doesn't have, it's simpler than Unix. So it's not, not going to be as featured as the interfaces we have in real Unix machines, which is what I'll be talking about a lot today. So Unix is so called because there was actually an original version of Unix. So there was some original operating system called Unix. Then there was Unix versions 1 through 4, then 5 and 6 and 7. And XV6 is like based on version 6 up here, but loosely. And there are a whole bunch of operating systems which are literally Unix in the sense that they share source code with the original Unix. There are also operating systems like, say, Linux, which are Unix-like operating systems but don't actually share source code with the original Unix. But that's where it comes from. And you can see that after AT&T developed the original versions of Unix, we had a whole bunch of different versions that are all derived from them. And there was a time when there were lots of commercially active Unix versions that people were using, and there was a problem that, let's say, I make Photoshop and I want to sell it to people who are using their Unix system. I want my version of Photoshop to work on all those systems. I want it to work on that SunOS machine and that AIX machine and that HPUX machine and that Next Step machine. I want it to work on all of them. At least I want most of the code. I don't want to like spend a lot of time rewriting everything for all of it. So there was an effort to standardize Unix called POSIX. So POSIX stands for the Portable Operating System Interface. And basically the idea is we had all these variations on Unix, and we want to have one interface that you can write your code for, and it will work on all of them. That was the idea of POSIX. And this standard is followed, or mostly followed, by basically all current Unix-like, like real OSs. XV6 doesn't really follow it, but that's to keep it like under 5,000 lines. But this is sort of standard as a minimum set. So most OSs add extra features, and there's some things that POSIX doesn't specify that might be important. Like booting, for example. Doesn't say anything about how that works. So POSIX defines an interface, a library, and a shell interface. So it's focused on source code compatibility. So there are things that we'll talk about as system calls, like later on. And when I say they're system calls, I mean in traditional Unix systems, like in the original Unix, they're system calls. And POSIX defines a function where, in a typical implementation, it's a wrapper for that system call. Like I showed you the write code for XV6. It just like makes a system call. There's a bunch of things that POSIX defines which typically work that way. But POSIX doesn't actually say what is or isn't a system call. All POSIX says is you can call a write function and it does this. So POSIX doesn't say it has to be implemented in our traditional way, but that's what we're going to be talking about in this class, is the, you know, the XV6 style implementation of it, even if you could do something else with different system calls, or maybe no system calls. Because POSIX was focusing on the source code compatibility, where the idea is you make your Photoshop implementation, and then you just recompile it for each version of Unix you want to use, and you have the software you ship to your customers on, in those days, physical media. Okay, so questions about the POSIX standard? Yeah. So the question is, what was it like before they had this? There was still like some informal agreement about what things did. And it turned out there were two major variants of Unix, which is where most of the differences were. There were variants derived from the Berkeley standard distribution and variants derived from System V here. System V here. So all the variants derived from here versus the variants derived from BSD over here. And so there's basically only two variations of things, and that's most of what POSIX was clarifying, which is why it wasn't too hard to standardize, probably. So other questions? Okay, so we're going to talk about how process management functions in POSIX work. This is going to come up a lot in our second assignment, which is writing a shell, which creates processes when you type commands. So, important. I'm going to start with, you know, our usually system call to get information about the current process, which is getPID. So getPID returns a PIDT, which is an integer of some sort. POSIX doesn't say how big an integer it is. I'm just casting it to a long to print it out. It might be a long, it might be an int, it might be a short. And this getPID returns my current process's PID. You can also see this in other places. So PS is a program which lists processes that you're running from your current shell. If you pass some extra arguments to it, it will list all processes. And you can see it lists PIDs. And as I mentioned, the PID is what you're going to need for various other operations that we see here that take a particular process. So we have wait for a process to finish. You need to say, what process am I waiting for? You pass a PID. You want to kill a process. You need to say, what one do I want to kill? You pass a PID. And that's the POSIX way of identifying what process am I talking about, so on. And when we create a process, you want to know what process did I just create. You'll get a PID back to let you know that. Okay, so we have a process creation function. And you might notice, weirdly, POSIX had made the choice that the process creation function and the running a program function are two different functions. So we'll talk about how that works in a bit. So how could they possibly be different program functions? But they are. So the process creation function, the main one is fork. And what fork does is it creates a new process by copying the current one. So this means that we have two copies of our process. We're going to be churning the first one and the second one. And the way we distinguish between the two is we return different values in the first one and the second one. So in the old process, we return the PID we just created. In the new process, we return 0 to indicate you're in the copy. And we copy everything. We copy everything about the process ID. We copy all the memory of the process. We copy all the file, open file information. We copy all the current values of registers. So a way you can think about this is that we have our process control block. We have our registers, we have our kernel stack, we have our user memory, and we have our open files. And conceptually, what's happening with fork is we're making a literal copy of that, a deep copy of that, in fact, or kind of deep copy of that. And we're also, you know, deep copying in the sense we're copying the memory. So we're making a new kernel stack and new memory to hold the program's actual data. And that's, you know, in a new array, list of open files, and so on. So that's what fork does. And this means that in our two copies, we have the same user registers and the same place we're returning to, and so on. And the same information on the stack. So, yeah.
So if you close one file after you forked, it's still open then?
The question is, if I close a file in this process, is it going to be open in this one? And the answer is yes, since it is a copy of the list of files. And if I write to memory in this one, in this process, it's not going to be appear in this process, because it's a copy. So one complaint you might have about this is that this seems really slow because I'm copying all of the memory. And here, like, it's really small, but, you know, what if it's, like, you know, my browser? We'll talk about efficient ways of doing that later, but it is an issue. There are more efficient ways. So with fork, I mentioned we return different things. So what fork does after the copy is we're going to set the return value in the parent, the original, to a different value than in the child. And this you can think of as just modifying the save registers to set the return value in XV6. Okay, so questions here. So if this is how fork works, let's look through an example of actually using this. So here I have a program. I have some header files I need to include for POSIX, and then I get my current PID and print it out. Then I call fork. And I said, in the original process, fork's going to return the PID we just created. So this code here is going to run in the original process, and it's going to print out its PID and the PID it got from fork. And this code here, if the child PID is 0, it's going to run in the child process. And the reason you can think of why do we return 0 to the child is because if the child wants to figure out what process we just created, it can figure that out by calling getPID, like we do here. And in the child, we print out child and the PID. And we have this third case here. So fork will return -1 if there's some sort of error. An example of an error might be we're out of memory. So in that case, we print an error message. PError will print fork failed, a colon, and then the cause of the last error. So any questions on this code? Yeah.
Is there a specific method in how PIDs are chosen for the child?
The question is there a specific method in how PIDs are chosen? No. Some processes will just choose the next available one, wrapping around. Some OSs will choose the next available one, wrapping around. Some will choose a random number and check if it's available, whatever they want to do. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, like, if the two, let's say our parent and child were both writing to the same file, how would that work? We'll get to that probably in a bit, maybe next time, though. Yeah.
Why isn't this call fork over and over again
in a loop? So fork, when we copy the process, we're copying it as we're returning from this fork function. So both copies are going to return from fork. We aren't going to go to the beginning of main, because that's exactly the point at which we copy the registers. Yes?
Is there a maximum number of processes?
The question is, there a maximum number of processes we can create? And absolutely, because we have finite memory.
So that's dependent on the memory.
Mainly on the memory. I mean, also, we could potentially run out of process IDs and some other resources like that. Question, is there a maximum process ID? Well, PIDT is some type of integer. So yes, it has a maximum value. OK, other questions? OK, so you can see my example here. If my parent process ID is 100, this will print out 100. Then it'll print out, I get PID in the parent. It's still 100 after I fork. I learn my child process ID is 432, and the child might print out 432. Now, this is one possible output, but fork just says we create a new process. It doesn't say anything about when that process gets to run. It just will run at some point. So with that in mind, we have an example here, and there are multiple outputs we can have because we don't know when the parent and child runs. So exercise, come up with at least two possible outputs. And you assume no crashes, like fork doesn't fail, and so on. You don't run out of memory. And you can check with your neighbor to see if you agree on if they're actually possible and different outputs. I mean, there's more than two. There's not actually that many, depending on how you think printf works.
Yeah, we literally could be
Okay. Who would like more time? Okay, can someone give me one possible output? Yeah. So, child 100 done. Is that the whole output? So we have two programs running, two processes running. I want the combined output.
Oh, and the other one is in child.
And in child, so how would this work together? So I want the combined output. So what's it like? I run this on my terminal, what should it look like? That's what I'm aiming for. I guess I could have made that clearer. I agree part of it is child 100 done. I want to know how the rest gets, how that those get combined. Okay, so you're saying in child, child 100, and done. Okay, so a subtlety here is that we need done will print twice. So I know you look at this and you say, well, this is the code, you look at here and you say, this is the code which runs in the child right here. So that's going to run in the child, but there's no exit at the end of it. So when we're done running that, we're just going to hop right along to here. And the same thing's true of the code that runs in the parent. So yeah, the if statements are kind of deceptive in that, like, they don't actually say that's all we do in the child or all we do in the parent. Yeah. So the question, so you're giving an option. So we have in child, child 100 done and done. And we have also, you say we could have in child done child 100. And I have possibly almost that. Okay. Example here. And what it depends on is when we decide to switch to the context switch, which might depend on like timers and things like that, so it's going to actually vary in practice. Like, it depends on like how slow or fast things run, because it depends on timer interrupts and like decisions we haven't talked about how we make yet, but which will vary over time. So those are two possible, and there's a bunch more. But they all have to have done printed twice. And we better not print done before both of the other things are printed. And one way of reasoning about this is to look at this picture here. Like, we start with one thing running, then we have the parent part, which runs this, the child, and the done. And we have the child part, which runs this and the done. And we have to go in order on that, you know, diagram of how things flow. Yeah. The question is, how can we have done twice consecutively? So the schedule, what happens here is we start running the parent, and we call fork here, let's say, and then we print out child 100 after the fork. Then, let's say, a timer interrupt happens, and the operating system decides, oh, time to run this new thing, and switches to the child. And it runs the child for a while and prints out in child. Then another timer interrupt happens. We switch back to the parent. And let's say print out done. And we switch back. And then another timer interrupt. And we print out done from the child, let's say. And that would be a way that could happen.
And does it have to start with the parent, or could it also start with the child?
The question is, does it have to start with the parent or start with the child? Yeah, either thing could, so the child can't run before fork happens, but potentially when we call fork, we immediately switch to the child. Yeah?
Is there a case where, so fork, so there's no child until that line of fork, or fork gets executed.
Yeah.
And then is there a case where like, we're back case where you said context switches before return, so you would have two different PIDs for a child and parent? But what if it sets the PID and then comes? Like, how does it differentiate or save two different PIDs?
The question is, how does fork save two different PIDs? So if you go back to our picture here, we have two process control blocks. So we have one place to save one PID and one place for the other one. And like one of these entries is a PID. So we have two different places to save it, depending which process we're in after we make the copy. So we just need to make sure we only modify one. Does that look still confused? So maybe not answering your question.
Part of it is just like magic.
Okay. Someone back there? No? Okay. Yeah.
So back to that code you had before. If you have like fork and then a little bit of code and then another fork, is it just like three avenues now that are going to bounce back?
So the question is, if I have a function like that does fork and fork like this.
Yeah, or like fork right before that last printf.
Okay, so like if I had a fork here.
Yeah.
So there would be three. In fact, there would be four, because the parent would make a new copy and the child would make a new copy. So we end up with four in total.
Okay.
Yeah. So the question is, will things be a zombie? We'll talk about the rules for cleaning up processes later, but you're correct that we aren't doing anything to figure out does the child exit or not, so something needs to happen about that. We'll talk about what the rules for that are later. Other questions? Okay. So this is creating a new process. And if you were thinking about our next assignment, which is implementing a shell where I can like type ls and we run the ls program, this may seem awfully disappointing because there's no way to run the ls program in this. I'm just running two copies of my program at once, which doesn't actually help me print out a file listing. So we have another thing for that, which is a bunch of functions whose names start with exec. And these are for running programs. And you might say, if running programs isn't creating processes, then how does that work? So exec replaced the current program with a new program. So they take you're in the same process. We just change what's running in that process to a different program. So this is the prototype for exec. It takes the executable to run, that's the path, and the arguments to pass to the executable. This is what's going to turn out to be argv in the new executable. So you can see an example here of using exec with fork. So we want to create a new process. So we're going to create a new process. And in that new process, we're going to call exec with ls minus l running the bin ls program. And this is going to run the file listing program that exists with the argument dash l. And it's going to replace the new process we create. So the sort of a picture of what happens is we have our parent process running. The parent process keeps running, and it's running the code down here. And we make a new child process. And it's going to get replaced by ls. So by ls minus l. So like another version of that picture is when we call that exec function, we're going to keep the same process control block, but we're just going to change everything in it to refer to the new program. So that means we're going to have a new stack, we're going to have new contents for memory, we're going to have new registers, but we actually won't change everything. So for example, the process ID won't change, and we also won't change the open files. They're going to stay the same. And that's useful, so if ls writes something to its output, it goes to the same place that it went in the original process. So we start the new process, and we have to do a little extra work to copy the arguments when we're creating the space for the new program. That's part of the process. And typically, what we'll do is we'll copy the arguments onto the new stack we're creating for the program we're replacing it with. Okay, so questions about this procedure? Yeah. So what about the current stack so the question is like, what about the kernel stack? So we don't need to change the kernel stack. We could do it, but we don't need to. So we can just leave that the same if we want. Yeah?
Why is this the way it's done in Unix?
Question is, why is this the way it's done in Unix? We'll talk about that in a bit. It's a good question, because it does seem very weird. Other questions? But a notable nice property, which might be part of why we do it, is that this sets up our open files in a nice convenient way. If you want to change what you're outputting to, which is one thing a shell can do, we have a way of doing that without actually changing how fork and exec work. We just don't do anything special. So that's one advantage, is that we can set things up for the new process without having extra arguments to exec using this way. Since you're doing an assignment, I have a brief note about exec and C++ and things, that the prototype for exec takes this type, and you probably don't know what that is because it doesn't come up very often. So this is a pointer to a constant pointer to a char. And notably, this should probably be a pointer to a const char, but it isn't. So if you have an array of constants, of constant strings, and try to pass it here, you'll get an error because you're trying to make something that's constant, not constant, because this char here is not constant. The solution, the workaround, is you can cast. So I'm mentioning this just because it's a frequently asked question about the shell assignment. Yeah?
So the exec, you said there were like multiple versions of it.
Yes.
Should we use XV, or is there another one?
The question is, there are multiple versions of exec I mentioned. Should we use exec V or others? I don't care what version you use. I think exec V is most relevant to the assignment, which is why I'm talking about it, and simplest to explain, but you can use whatever works, as long as it actually exists on the system we're testing on. So one aside related to those other versions is that the other versions have this thing called environment variables. So it turns out that in addition to arguments, there's a second thing passed through exec, which are these key value pairs associated with processes. And these include some important things like, where do I find programs to run? There's the path. Or what is my current shell if I want to run a new shell? So we're not going to talk about them except to say they exist, and that there are functions for accessing them, and there's a version of exec which takes a pointer to them, which is the reason I'm mentioning it now. So this is passed in when we start a new process. You mostly don't need to be concerned about it, but that's why when you look up the manual for exec, you'll see, what's this execve thing? What's this envp? It's a list of these key value pairs, which might include things like, where's my home directory? What shell do I use? And so on. Question is, what does the V stand for? I believe it stands for like vector, because it takes an array, an array that's terminated with a zero element. Okay. Other questions? So, mention environment variables just because you will see them if you use Unix a lot. So I mentioned where to look for programs. In our shell, we're not going to implement that feature, so you don't actually need to do it. But in normal shells, there's a list of directories to look for executables. Like if I type ls, I have to figure out where is the actual copy of the ls program. You look in that environment variable to figure out where to look. You probably find that it's in slash bin, where my home directory is, and so on. Okay. Yes?
Where are the environment variables stored?
So the question is, where are the environment variables stored? So in the like full version of exec, looks something like this. So they're passed in with the arguments, and usually they're stored in roughly the same area of memory. But this might vary. Okay, other questions? Okay, so we had fork and exec. So this is our way to write a new program. We first fork to make a new process, and then we exec to throw away everything that we copied into that new process. Well, not everything, but a lot of things we copied from that process, something new. So this seems awfully wasteful. And we could just have a function which is spawn a new process running a particular program. And in fact, this is a real thing operating systems do. So Windows has a function called create process, which says create a new process running this program from the beginning, not from the middle. And POSIX has a function for this that is very recent and very rarely used called POSIX spawn. So the disadvantage of this approach is we need to be able to set what the new program's state is. Like what files does it have open, what directory is it in, and so on. We need some way of specifying what should that be. And the fork exec lets us fork, change like what our current directory is, and then run the program in a different directory. We can't easily do that with the create process style API unless create process has an argument saying, what should the current directory be? And that's, in fact, what the sort of thing they'll do. But it has the advantage that we don't have to copy everything in the process code, which we clearly needed to have to implement fork. And the API for this is pretty straightforward. So here's like a minimal call to POSIX spawn. I might be missing an argument here. This is what I get for. Sorry. I'm missing the most important argument of what program to spawn. But this is what a call to POSIX spawn is, a pointer to where we went to store the PID, the program to run, and the arguments, and a bunch of other optional arguments to specify things like what files do I want to open in the new process, what other special settings do I want, and so on. Yes?
Does exec also change the image name of the process name in the central block?
The question is, does exec change the name? So in XV6, yes. XV6 exec does that. Presumably it would in other OSs which keep track of a name, which we don't have to do. Okay, other questions? So I said like there's this alternative to fork, and there are certainly people, including like this is via Hot OS, Hot Topics and Operating Systems Workshop from this year, who like really don't like fork. Really don't like it. But it's very common, and like the elegance is that you don't have to have these separate APIs for setting up your new process. That's just free. But it does create some disadvantages. So some people think it's bad. This is obviously an opinion. In a Hot Topics conference, you're more likely to be accepted if you have very strong opinions in your paper. Compromises OS implementations. Okay, so questions about fork and exec? Okay, so we have a few other things we need to do with processes. So when I'm writing a process from a shell, when we talked about how fork worked, we saw that there's no guarantee that the child or parent executed at any particular time. If I think of like going into my shell and typing ls enter, I expect my shell not to print things out until LS is done, you know, actually printing out the listing. So we need some way of waiting for programs. And the main function I'll talk about for that is wait PID. There's also a bunch of variants of this, like with exec, which I'll start with wait. But we'll talk mainly about wait PID. So wait PID, it takes a process ID to wait for and a place to store the status of the process. I'll talk about what that is in a bit, and some options. So it looks like you can only wait for one process. Turns out you can supply a PID of -1 to wait for all your child processes. So a child process is one that your process forked, and that's all you can wait PID for. So you might like to wait for a program you didn't run. Sorry, you're not allowed. You can only wait for programs that you forked. In this way, if you have a program you didn't run, you need to do something else. And you can potentially wait for all the programs you ran. And there are also some options. So by default, wait PID is going to wait for either any program to finish, if you specify -1, or the program you specify to finish. But you can pass an option of W no hang to say, hey, if this process isn't done yet, just tell me it's not done, and we're going to do something else. So in your shell, that's not very useful for what will have you implement it. But if you were implementing background processes, that's what you want to do. You say, I ran this thing in the background a while ago. Is it done now? And you can just call wait PID to check, is it done, and so on. And if you call with an options of 0, you're just saying, tell me, I'm going to hang on. Don't return to me until it's actually finished. Okay.
Is the child of a child considered a child?
So the question is, if I spawn a process with fork and it spawns another process, can I wait for it? And the answer is no. So, other questions? Okay. Yeah.
So, if you set PID equal to 0, does it just wait for the next process to finish?
The question is, if I set PID equal to 0, what's going to happen? And the answer is, I think it returns an error because that's not going to be a valid PID. So, -1 is the special value for a PID to wait for the next thing to finish. Otherwise, you have to, not 0. 0 is just not valid. Yeah. The question is, how does the process know how many children it has? So the simplest way is when you call fork, you write down in some part of your memory that you called fork and what the return value was. If you don't do that, you can run PS to figure out all the processes and try to figure out which are yours, but generally there's not actually a reliable way to do it in POSIX. In fact, the best way in POSIX is to run PS. There's no way to query, what are my child processes other than waiting for them to finish. So in your shell, what you should definitely do is, don't call fork and assume I'll figure out the PID later, just record the PID. Especially because you need to detect errors anyways. So you better check if it's -1, meaning you ran out of memory. You want to know that. Other questions? Okay, so we have the status. So the status encodes some information, and most notably, you may vaguely remember that you return, we have this boilerplate of return 0 from main, or exit 0, and you can exit with other numbers. So part of the status is, what are we returning from main, or what are we calling exit with? So that's the most interesting part of the status. There's other information that's in there that I'll talk about in a bit. So keep that in mind. Here's our example await PID. So here, I fork, and in the parent, I call wait PID, record the status somewhere for the child. And the child, I do something else. Maybe I exec a different program, or maybe I just do some computation in the next set. Well, whatever happens, I'm going to wait for that child to exit. and then get back a status. So I need to interpret that status, and you would think, oh, if we return 0 from main, you know, that's an int, and the status is an int, therefore I'm just the return value of main, and that's a good guess, but that's not actually how things work. So the status is this number which encodes both the return value and also some extra information about did we exit normally or not. Because it could be the case that you ran a program and it just exited, but it could also have segfaulted. And WaitPID is going to tell you that with that status variable. So there are these macros starting with W for wait, where you, after you set the status, you can check, did it exit normally? And if so, what did it return from main? And you have to extract that because it's not just going to be one if you returned one from main or exited with one. It's going to be something else. And there's also this option for signaled, which is the most notable other type. So there's killed by a signal. And signals are the name for things that you can send to processes. And also, there's this sort of flag that the operating system in POSIX will send to your process when you do certain bad things or we want to do things to terminate you. So for example, control C turns into a signal called sigint. So if I control C and that stops a program, in here, it's going to print out killed by signal and whatever the number that sigint is. Sigint is just an integer constant. And that's going to be what's going to be returned from W term sig. And if I kill it with the kill command, it's going to return the integer constant sig term. If there's a seg fault, it's going to return the constant sig segv. And there's a whole bunch of these other values for all the other sorts of abnormal ways our processes can terminate, you know, that is not by calling xset or returning from main. And this is how, when you think of your shell, like you run a program and it prints segmentation fault, it's not the OS printing that, it's the shell printing that. The shell called WaitPID, it figured out, oh, it exited with a seg fault, and it prints it out segmentation fault for you to let you know what happened. Okay, so okay, questions? Yeah.
Can you write single handlers for XV6?
Question is, can you write single handlers for XV6? XV6 does not implement singles. So no. Yes.
Question, what is WaitPID return?
WaitPID's return type is a PIDT. And you might say, what's that used for? If you pass -1 as the input PID, the return value lets you know what process did you actually wait for. Also, it's going to be -1 if there was an error. One example of an error is you're waiting, there's nothing to wait for. Another, you know, there might be other errors like you passed an invalid pointer for the status.
Sometimes when you press control C, it doesn't kill the
process. So I said that it signals, so as mentioned on the slide, signals are like usually we think of them as just ways of killing programs. They're actually ways of communicating with programs. So the way control C really works is that if it sends a signal, the process can elect to handle it and receive it as a communication, basically. So that's the most common way. Another thing which can happen is that you can reconfigure whether control C sends a signal or not. So one of those two things are happening. Other questions? Okay. So now we have all our important components for actually running programs, and this gives us the pattern that we'll actually be using. That typically you'll have your parent program, like your shell, it will call fork, the child process will call exec, and whatever it execs will exit eventually.
and the parent will call wait PID, which will pause the parent until that exit happens. Okay, so questions, this pattern. So, or with code, we're gonna call fork, we're gonna detect if we're in the child, if so, we're gonna exec, and if we're in the parent, we're gonna wait. This is the sort of typical, I just want to run program, this is what it looks like. And we can extend this pattern to run more than one program. So I could fork and exec a whole bunch of times, and then wait a whole bunch of times. And this is typically what I'd end up doing on, you know, something like our shell. Or you can do it in this way, where we would wait for anything and like look up the PID that finished to figure out what to do. So questions on these sort of patterns of how we use fork and exec and wait? Okay. So there was a question earlier about children of children. So that is a thing which exists. So we have this, we have parent processes, which when they fork, that creates a child process. And we actually keep track of what the parent process of every process is. And we need to do that because wait needs to know, can you wait for this or not? And in fact, there's a system call, getPPID, for getParentPID, which reads your own parent process ID. And if we look at this, we have a tree of processes are created from this. Every process has a parent, you know, and every process has one or zero or more child processes, which we can identify because they have their parent PID set to its PID. And in fact, there's a command like which will give you this tree representation of what's running. So you might have some questions given how things work. So one question is like, let's say a parent exits before the child. Like, so get PPID, you know, that process ID no longer refers to a process now. So like I spawned something in my shell, it was still running, and I closed my shell. What happens to that thing that was still running? It needs to have a parent process ID, and its parent process ID becomes 1, is the rule in POSIX. And typically process ID 1 is something called init, and part of its job is to clean up and wait for and report information about all the other programs that are running and finishing. So anything which gets lost because someone forgot to wait for the program. Now, if the parent keeps running but it never waits, the process stays around as what we call a zombie. And the reason for this is we need to reserve that PID so I can call wait and get the status of how it finished. If I don't do that, if I just got rid of it right away, then we, you know, like we run something and it seg faults and we'll never find out about it. So we need to keep that around and we need to reserve the PID because let's say I fork a new program before I call wait, I might get, if I reuse that PID, I can't distinguish between the two anymore. And that would be really bad. So we reserve the PID at least. And this is what's called a zombie because it's not running, but it's still like in your process list. Because we have to keep track of it. Yeah?
So does that mean that the child process just immediately just halts?
Question is, that mean in the... In what case does the child process halt? So the question is, the parent finishes before the child, does the child process halt? No, the child process gets to keep running, but instead of the parent figuring out whether it exited, the special init program gets to do that, does that in its place. And it can like log a message saying it exited or not or whatever. Yes?
Does the child track the parent, and if so, what does it do if the process is on the parent's ultimate?
The question is, does the child track the parent?
Yes.
Yes. And what happens if the question of what happens if the parent exits and is replaced? Part of making the parent exit and implementing the operating system is going to be making sure all the children are updated about who their parent is. So we're going to have when the parent exits, we have to like say, here are all the child processes. Let's change their parent right now before that PID gets reused. Yeah.
Does init have a parent?
Question is, does init have a parent? No. It is special.
in instance, I think from my memory of code,
yes, sir. Sorry, I'm out of time. So that's all I have for today. So next time, so XV6 homework is due on Friday, and next time we'll talk more about the remaining pieces of process management and also files. Yeah,